Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, now we're going to do some news now. I think you'll find this interesting. Let me read Bev's shithole weather contribution for the day. Good morning from Churchbridge, Mac. Mostly sunny skies today. Northwest winds at 21 miles an hour. The current temp is 5 above. Feels like 13 below. The afternoon high will be 23 above. All Marine Radio continues to educate me. Your Friday comment about the Carnegie Library piqued my curiosity. Thanks, Mac. I never knew that Regina and North Battleford were given funds. Regina demolished their library in 1961 to build a new public central library. Built in 1916, North Battleford in north central Saskatchewan used theirs until 1988 when a new city library was built. Since 1989, the building has been home of the Allen Sapp Gallery, a Plains Cree Indian who lived there from 1928 to 2015. And there's a picture of it. You know, and they're just beautiful, classic building. Yeah. So, yeah, the Carnegie Library program around, I don't know if it was around the world, certainly around North America. Yeah, pretty interesting. So, all right, I want to read you just some headlines. All right, just a smattering of current events. Side effect of pandemic, Loneliness. Stocks plunge as Fed's drastic move fails to calm the market. Coronavirus news to stay informed, advice to stay safe. Another one. Global stocks are plunging despite central bank moves. Coronavirus may delay NFL stadiums in Las Vegas and Los Angeles. Uh-oh. Is the Fed out of ammunition now? On our own, suspended minor league baseball players left scrambling. Breaking news concerning the U.S. economy. Fed takes emergency steps to slash rates. You can see a little bit of a trend here, right? Nikki and Brie Bella show off their bikini bumps in their baby bumps in bikinis. Yeah, how about that? Crude oil falls below $30 as coronavirus spreads into the oil sector. Andrew Gillum wants a rising politician in Florida who ran for governor, I believe, was found drunk with a male escort who has passed out with a drug overdose last week. He enters alcohol rehab. From the Wall Street Journal, lenders deluge with refinance requests amid virus frenzy. So there you go. Interest rates drop, money's cheap. You're going to see a flurry of refining activity as people attempt to take advantage of it, get their home refinanced at a cheaper rate. Dr. Safier, I don't know who that is, but anyway, we don't need people going out to bars and restaurants. Now, if you looked at, I don't know if you were on the internet over the weekend, you saw pictures of bars, people partying and whatnot, right? And like, you know, you see these captions, YOLO. Coronavirus isn't stopping me. Got it. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders had a debate last night. They clashed over Social Security. Go to the YouTube. All right? Go to the YouTube. Now, I'm curious about things like this. Right? Here's another one. Major Las Vegas resorts closing in response to coronavirus. California Governor Newsom orders home isolation for the elderly. What does that mean? Orders home isolation. So what happens if you're old and you don't do that? Does it have the power of anything more than a governor's decree? So all these things that are being, quote unquote, ordered, like your restaurant is being ordered to shut down. Can you be cited if you don't shut your restaurant down? Is it a recommendation? What is it? What is the legal power of the governor in this case? Here's another one. People line up to buy guns and ammunition amid the virus scare. Ralph Charette, 71, said he bought a rifle and ammunition on Saturday to protect himself and his family as a wave of coronavirus panic sweeps across the country. Charette, a military veteran, spent $1,500 at a gun shop in Germantown, Wisconsin, after encountering aggressive shoppers and empty shelves at local grocery stores. Now, if looters come knocking, he'll be ready, he said. Quote, there's so much uncertainty and paranoia, but you've got to protect your own, Charette said. Charette is among a growing number of Americans who are going to retailers, pawn shops, and online to purchase guns and ammunition in the wake of the COVID-19 virus scare, which has killed more than 60 people in the United States as of Saturday afternoon. As hysteria surrounding the illness drives some to stockpile groceries and toilet paper in case they're quarantined, it's also causing many to worry about a shortage of gun supplies, which is driving up demand and leading to long lines at suppliers. Lengthy lines formed outside of the Martin Redding Gun Store in Culver City, California, on Sunday morning before the store opened. People said the line Saturday was too long, extending around the block, so they decided to come back and try again. Many said they were looking for extra protection, primarily ammunition, in case the virus shuts down most businesses. The trend continued outside Turner's Outdoorsman in Torrance, California. People are scared, said Drew Plotkin from Los Angeles. There's a lot of panic in the world, and people want to be protected in the worst-case scenario. In Newcastle, Delaware, Emily Kent, 22, bought ammunition this weekend for her 9mm before doomsday preppers could buy all the supplies, she said. So, anyway, that's just a smattering of news headlines from around the country. So, there you go. I think if you follow the advice of Dr. Fauci, and you'll hear him in a second, you'll be all right. Okay? That's why I say you might want to stay, read a book, do something else. You don't need to listen to this nonsense. Because if you just do what you're told, 98% of us are going to be all right. So, all right. Now, speaking of Dr. Fauci, he made the rounds yesterday, and he did this with Chris Wallace from, it's called what, Fox News Sunday? So, and then he was on with Chuck Todd, he was on all the major shows, and so he's kind of become the point man, right? And the problem people have with Dr. Fauci is that he's a likable guy, right? As opposed to the president, who, you know, most of people in the media do not particularly care for. So, here's Dr. Fauci on Fox News Sunday.
The government's top official on infectious diseases. And doctor, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
Good to be with you, Chris.
I want to start with those videos that Kristen Fisher just showed of those thousands of people at airports overnight rushing to beat the travel ban, waiting online for hours. You can see them here in close proximity, one assumes, coming back from Europe. Some of them have the coronavirus. As an infectious disease doctor, are you troubled seeing this?
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to not see crowds like that. I mean, I think what people need to understand, if you're an American citizen, if you are a family member, that you can get back. You don't need to rush back. You'll be able to get back. But it's understandable how when people see a travel ban, they immediately want to hunker and get home. Hopefully, we don't have more of that, but I think we probably, unfortunately, will see that.
And is that a problem in terms of the spread of the disease?
I mean, obviously, whenever you have crowds, I mean, that's the thing we've been talking about and that we really want to implement.
One of the things that's most interesting is that, you know, every one of these interviews, it's like a reporter. What are you trying to do? You're trying to get the information out, right? But it's like they're trying so hard to find things that are wrong. You know, he gets taken to task for touching the microphone during a press conference, right? Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. You touched the microphone. Well, if I didn't touch the microphone, people couldn't hear me, Chuck. Right? So it just gets so stupid all of a sudden. So look, what should we do? You know, what should we do relative to this? Somebody's got to stop at some place. Somebody's got to get screened someplace. Should we just not do that then and let them come to the country? And then we'll keep our fingers crossed? No. It's not optimum. It's not. And if maybe you should come 6 hours before. Maybe you can avoid a line like that. All right. So, but it's just, I don't know. It's just so irritating when it feels like they're snarky selves. And I like this guy, right? And as a questioner, but still, it pisses me off.
Separation, that is countermanding that, and hopefully that people will understand you don't have to rush back.
And to what degree is it on the airports to prevent that and not have those big crowds of people waiting for hours?
I don't know, Chris, with the...
How do you prevent it? How do you prevent it? How do you tell people you can't come? Right? Do you have people monitoring those lines and say, okay, everybody's got to be 3 feet apart. You can't be any closer. So the line goes forever. Right? The line goes forever. So anyway, I don't know. It's just like...
The airports can do about that to try and encourage people to tell them that if you are an American citizen, you will be able to get back. It's not going to be a problem.
You testified before Congress this week, and you made, I think, what most people would consider some pretty chilling comments. Here they are.
Bottom line, it's going to get worse. The flu has a mortality of 0.1%.
Sure.
This has a mortality of 10 times that.
What's different about this virus? What's different in how contagious it is and how lethal it is?
Well, I would say three things, Chris. One, it's brand new, so we don't have any prior experience about what it's going to do, what its dynamics are going to be. Number two, it spreads very easily. There's no doubt about that. It isn't like some of the other outbreaks that we had that just didn't adapt itself to spread among humans. And number three, it's very serious in the sense of morbidity and mortality, particularly among and very heavily weighted towards individuals who are more susceptible, the elderly and those with underlying conditions.
And in terms of contagiousness and lethality, worse than the flu?
Well, yes. I mean, it just is. And we've got to face that fact. We've got to be realistic. I mean, we've got to realize, and I said that at the hearing, that things are going to get worse before they get better. But the kinds of things we're doing now will hopefully mitigate that. You know, I showed that curve.
We're going to talk about that.
But that's important because to think that right now everything is going to be okay if you don't do anything, that's absolutely incorrect. We've got to really always be ahead of the curve. I mean, I say now in a way that people can understand, I'd like to be the fact that we're criticized for being overreactive. Because when you're dealing with a virus outbreak, you are always behind where you think you are. So therefore, you've got to jump ahead and stay ahead of the curve.
I want to ask you about this. On Friday, both you and the president at one point mentioned 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't saying it's all going to be over in 8 weeks, but are you suggesting that if we do everything right, that we could be on the other side of the curve in 8 weeks?
Yeah, the answer, first of all, we have to say that people don't misunderstand. We are not sure what the duration is going to be, number one. Number two, if you look at what happened in China, where they had that peak and then they are coming down. There were only 11 new cases in China. They dominated the new cases just a few months ago. So if it started off in China, you know, 2 or 3 months ago, they started coming down within a 2-month period. So if you're talking about reflecting what went on there, it's going to be about that time that we hopefully in the next couple of months are going to see the direction it's going to go. Hopefully what we're doing in a very aggressive way of containment and mitigation, we'll be able to not only flatten it in the sense of not as many cases, but also diminish the duration.
President Trump announced a public-private partnership on Friday and made it sound like serious testing around the country that we'll be seeing it soon. First, there was this.
I want to thank Google. Google is helping to develop a website. It's going to be very quickly done, unlike websites of the past.
But Google's sister company, Verily, put out a statement later that said this test, which, according to him and other officials, first of all, will let you sort of check whether your symptoms indicate you have it, and two, if you do seem to have it, will tell you where you can get testing. In fact, is just starting and is just in a pilot program for the Bay Area, and that it's going to take over time, they said, for it to be applied nationally. And while the president made it sound like mass testing is going to start very soon, there are a lot of experts who say that whether it's staffing, public health staffing, or the products or the chemicals needed for mass testing, that we're way behind the curve on that. So I guess my question is, how soon can people across the country expect mass drive-through testing?
Okay, so there are two issues here, Chris. There's a website and when it's going to be fully open versus the availability of testing. They really are somewhat separate. So put aside the website and how it's going to be fully operational. The CEOs of the companies that we had at the White House, that the president met with, it's very clear that when I specifically asked them, when can we get started to start doing this, where you can really have availability in a much easier way, implementing, not just saying that it's out there. They're telling us that that will be starting up within the next week or so, that it's going to go up. Now, in the reality, there are going to be people a week from now who are going to say, I tried to get a test and I couldn't get it. But the totality of the picture is going to be infinitely better than it was a few weeks ago.
I want to talk to you about a few weeks ago, because there are continuing questions about why other countries, South Korea may be the best example, are testing thousands of people a day. And so far, the CDC says that it and state labs total, the whole crisis, have tested 13,000 people. Here's how you and the president answered questions about the testing lag this week.
The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
No, I don't take responsibility at all, because we were given set of circumstances, and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time.
The president says the Obama administration set up rules and regulations that made it impossible to do testing. You were in the same position under the Obama administration. Is that true? Is that what stopped it?
You know, Chris, to be honest with you, I'm not sure what regulations and when it was that they're talking about. I really mean that. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what it is that these things were in place that were able to or inhibiting. But one thing that I do know now is that the ability to get a test had some regulatory and other restrictions on it, but the FDA now has just gotten rid of.
I mean, they could have done that day one.
Well, yeah, they could have, but the fact is it wasn't. So I tend to like to, instead of looking back, look at where we're going.
All right. You talk about slowing the virus down. You talk a lot, and I've gotten very used to this now. You could either have a bump like this of cases, or you could make it maybe the same total cases, but it's a much more gradual and slower and longer curve. I want to put up some numbers. We have in this country about 950,000 hospital beds and about 45,000 beds in intensive care units. How worried are you that this virus is going to overwhelm hospitals, not just beds, but ventilators? We only have 160,000 ventilators. And could we be in a situation where you have to ration who gets the bed, who gets the ventilator?
Okay, so let me put it in a way that it doesn't get taken out of context. When people talk about modeling where outbreaks are going, the modeling is only as good as the assumptions you put into the modeling.
Right.
And what they do, they have a worst case scenario, a best case scenario, and likely where it's going to be. If we have a worst case scenario, we've got to admit it, we could be overwhelmed. Are we going to have a worst case scenario? I don't think so. I hope not. What are we doing to not have that worst case scenario? That's when you get into the things that we're doing.
We're preventing infections from going in with some rather stringent travel restrictions, and we're doing containment and mitigation from within. So at a worst case scenario, anywhere in the world, no matter what country you are, you won't be prepared. So our job is to not let that worst case scenario happen.
And final question. Three countries now in Europe, Italy, Spain, and France, are basically in total lockdown. People not allowed out. In Italy, I think only pharmacies and grocery stores are open. You see people on the balconies singing songs and banging pots. Could that happen here, either nationally or in some regions? And what about the possibility that we might have to have travel bans inside the country?
Well, a couple of questions there. So let me take one at a time.
Yep.
The idea of what's going on in Europe is that they have been they got into that escalation phase. So what they're doing now is playing catch up. We feel that with rather stringent mitigation and containment, without necessarily complete lockdown, we'd be able to prevent ourselves from getting to where, unfortunately, Italy is now. With regard to domestic travel bans, we always talk about and consider everything, but I can tell you that has not been seriously considered, doing travel bans in the country. Would it? Might be sometime. We always leave an open mind.
Dr. Fauci? Thank you. Thanks for coming in. An awful lot of people are relying on what you have to say. And, of course, we'll be tracking what the president's task force does this week. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That is Chris Wallace. So I think when you – to me, the thing that I took away from all that is when you do modeling, right, there's a, you know, best case, worst case, and then there's something, you know, that's probably realistic that's somewhere in the middle of that. And I think his point is well made that, you know, the worst case scenario will overwhelm anybody's capacity. But probably the most important thing that happened was the mitigation of the people coming from Asia in January. And so which slowed the growth in the United States. And now hopefully with, you know, schools being shut down, with, you know, most public assemblies being shut down, that gives the medical system a little bit of breathing room to deal with this around the country. And so that you'll see our mortality rate not being what it is around the world. So I think Dr. Fauci, you know, pretty good job in all of that. Now, I want to play a interview that was done yesterday. I've got to find it. General McKenzie from CENTCOM did it on Friday. And I got to make sure I get the right one, because I don't want to get the one. I don't want to get the one with the, you know how all of a sudden the. Commercials pop up, what they, and all that. This is from Facebook. So this is General McKenzie. From 3 days ago. Now, again, we're all waiting for some kind of response from the American military relative to the latest attack in Iraq. So essentially what happened was Iranian militia said, yeah, we've been kind of quiet, but here you go, and killed two Americans and a Brit. Our response was pretty weak, and that we played the whack-a-mole game. And they got attacked again. Now, you're not going to hear anything about that. But here's General McKenzie from Friday from the Pentagon.
the last few days. Two Marines were killed in mountainous terrain in northern Iraq in an advise and accompany mission with our Iraqi partners during a mission against the remains of ISIS. A third Marine was killed in a vehicle accident in the United Arab Emirates during Exercise Native Fury. Finally, and most recently, a U.S. Army soldier and a U.S. Air Force airman and a medic from the United Kingdom were killed during a rocket attack by an Iranian-backed militia, Khatib Hezbollah, on Camp Taji, which is an Iraqi base that hosts coalition forces engaged in the fight against ISIS.
All right, now just
beyond those killed,
this is General McKenzie. He's the head of CENTCOM, right? He's been in the United States, in the continental United States, testifying right in front of the House Armed Service Committee and the Senate Armed Service Committee this past week. And then on Friday, he held this press conference.
I want to recognize the 18 combat wounded service members and civilians. We also want to recognize two additional service members who were injured in non-combat injuries involved in the vehicle rollover in Native Fury. Our thoughts and prayers are with the friends and families of those killed and wounded, and we wish a speedy and full recovery to the wounded and the injured. I'd like to brief you on last night's defensive strikes on five Iranian-backed Khatib Hezbollah advanced conventional weapons storage units in Iraq. Up front, we have information that confirms that Khatib Hezbollah conducted the rocket attacks on Camp Taji on March the 11th that killed three coalition members and injured 14 others. We also assess that Khatib Hezbollah has been involved in 12 rocket attacks against coalition forces in the last 6 months. In response to this attack on an Iraqi base that hosts coalition forces supporting the Iraqi fight against ISIS, we carried out precision defensive strikes to degrade and destroy advanced conventional weapons that have been provided to Khatib Hezbollah by their Iranian backers. Let's go to the first slide, please. So what you see on the graphic there are the five targets that we struck. I'll just briefly call them out for you. What we call target A1 is the Arab Nawar Ahmad rocket storage facility. A2 is the Jurfa Sakhr IRAM storage facility. And, of course, IRAM are the improved heavy rockets that are so lethal. A3 is the Kabbalah KH advanced conventional weapons storage facility. A4 is the Al-Musakib terrorist weapons storage facility, and A5 is another Jurfa Sakhr facility. It's the propellant production facility and storage sites. So I'm going to hold those images for just a minute. We struck them at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We assessed that each location stored weapons that would enable lethal operations against U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. We also assessed that the destruction of these sites will degrade Khatib Hezbollah's ability to conduct future strikes. While we face significant weather issues and continue to face significant weather issues in the Baghdad area, it prevented clear photos and videos of that we would like at the level we'd like to share with you. We do have some images, and we are confident that we have effectively destroyed these facilities and expect they will no longer be able to house the type of advanced Iranian-supplied weapons that were used in the Khatib Hezbollah attacks on the Iraqi base at Camp Taji. So let's go to the next slide, please. Same format. These are the after images, and
So essentially, they struck ammunition bunkers. They ring back that they're in the north, the northwest, the west, the southwest, and the southeast. They ring back that. Now, any of us who've ever spent any time in Iraq, there's so many, you know, magazines and ammunition storage abilities. That's why I said, you talk about a weak response, you know. So, and I haven't heard this whole thing, but I'm very curious. How is this deterrent to them? They know what we're going to do. They probably instructed all their fighters, get the hell away from any bases, go out in the desert, have tea, spend the night, right? You know how the Americans do their thing. They'll hit facilities.
I'm sure we're going to provide this to you in hard copy so that you can see them as well after the brief this morning. But we assess success at all sites, and we're very comfortable with the level of damage that we were able to achieve. And you can see it. And I know it's a little hard to see from a distance, but we'll make sure you actually get the slides. The strikes were all conducted by manned fighter aircraft, and they recovered safely at the completion of their mission. I'm not going to be able to give you any specific information about where the aircraft were based, and I'm not going to be able to provide any more details about the type of weapons that we employed. But as you can see from the imagery, they were all precise weapons, carefully calibrated by our weaponeers to achieve maximum effect on the target and minimize collateral damage. I also want to reiterate that these strikes, these defensive strikes, were designed to destroy Iranian-supplied advanced conventional weapons, and that the United States acted in self-defense in response to a direct and deliberate attack on an Iraqi base that hosts coalition service members. We are in Iraq to support the people of Iraq in their fight against ISIS. However, we always reserve the right to defend our forces whenever they're attacked or threatened. Finally, I would caution Iran and its proxies from attempting a response that would endanger U.S. and coalition forces or our partners. U.S. Central Command is well postured to defend our forces around the region and to respond to any further aggression against our forces. In fact, I have asked, and the Secretary is.
Well, we all know what the Iranians said to that, and that is, go screw yourself. We're not afraid of you. So the question is, why? The question is, why? Why are the Iranians trying to provoke something? Okay? General McKenzie goes on.
Granted my request to continue to operate two aircraft carrier strike groups in the region, which is the first period of extended dual U.S. carrier operations in U.S. Central Command since, we believe, around 2012. We have the flexibility, the capability, and the will to respond to any threat. With that, I'll be happy to take your questions.
General, thank you. Can you tell us what your assessment is of any casualties in the strikes? And secondly, more broadly, can you talk about whether or not you think this does escalate tensions with Iran and whether Iran directed these strikes?
Sure. So we're still assessing damage on the target sites. As I noted earlier, weather in the Baghdad area has prevented us from really following up. So I don't have any numbers for you right now. But we believe that the collateral damage is going to be very low. We expect there are going to be fatalities on the objective, but I don't have those numbers for you right now. We'll work to get those out here in the future, in the near future, as we continue. We believe that this is going to have an effect on deterring future strikes of this nature. We've seen in the past what happens when you don't respond. Now people know that we're not going to tolerate these direct attacks on American or coalition service members, and we're willing and able to respond.
Now, just for the record, he's made no comment since this press conference.
Khatib Hezbollah is closely linked to Iran. I couldn't tell you the details of the particular connection on this strike because I just don't know those yet. But we know morally there's a very strong connection between the two.
You can't at this moment, or you don't think you have enough evidence to directly tie this.
I'm not going to. That's as far as I'll go on that.
General McKenzie, is there any evidence that you killed General Siaman Mashadani, who's a top IRGC commander, in the strikes? And has there been any response from the PMU? There were reports of some rockets being fired at K-1 base. Have you seen any response so far?
So I'll start on the back end of that question. We've seen no response yet. And, of course, we track that very closely. Something may have happened in just a few minutes before I walked in. But as of a little while ago, when I talked to General White, we had no information on that. I have no information on any IRGC general being killed or injured.
David. General, presumably you knew about these sites before last night. So the question is, why wait until after American service members are killed to strike them?
Sure. So we're in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. We always want to work with the Iraqi government to minimize these types of attack. We believe that Iraqi security forces have actually been active trying to reduce this levels of attack. We don't look for opportunities to attack to cause casualties. But if we're struck, we're going to strike back. So that's probably the reason this occurred at this time rather than earlier.
Did you ask the Iraqi government to do something about those particular sites earlier?
We're in constant communication with the Iraqi government about intelligence that we have and that they have about Khatib Hezbollah and their locations.
General McKenzie, I actually want to follow up on David's question. Just to make clear, I understand what you're saying, but are you saying that U.S. military or U.S. policy is that you have to wait to be attacked. If you could just explain that a little bit more. And I wanted to also ask you, now that several weeks have gone by since Soleimani's killing, his loyalists had made a number of statements right afterwards that they were going to try and enact revenge, possibly against U.S. officials. They had a lot of very hot rhetoric. Have you seen any evidence of Soleimani's loyalists trying to carry out any of that? But could you clarify?
Sure. So, Barbara, we never have to wait to be struck. If we believe that an attack is imminent or that we can prevent a blow from being landed by taking action, I and my commanders have full authority to do that.
So, again, why could you help us understand, in two cases now, the original, the ones back in December and these, you only did it after the U.S. was attacked?
Well, so the missiles, the rockets, the 107s that struck Camp Taji were not fired from these locations. They were fired from another location. So we actually, in concert with our Iraqi partners, helped us recover the vehicle and the launch site for this. So we acted against that. The strikes that you see now are designed to send a clear, unambiguous signal that we will not tolerate this behavior in the future going forward.
Soleimani?
So, talk a little bit about Soleimani. Let me just observe, first of all, they missed Soleimani. He was one who held a lot of things together for them. And over time, he had grown to dominate a lot of their decision making. In the wake of his death, I think they're still struggling to find a way to come together and make good and effective decisions. And they're still trying to find a way to actually have effective command and control over some of the groups in Iraq going forward.
Any evidence they're trying to carry out?
I think we saw an attack a couple of days ago right here. I would not be prepared to ascribe it directly to a revenge for that, but I think clearly we're going to continue to see a reaction to that.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been pointed out that the Camp Taji attack coincided with Soleimani's 63rd birthday. Is it CENTCOM's opinion that that's coincidence or that could have been a motive for the attack?
I don't have enough information to do anything other than acknowledge that it happened on that day.
And the CENTCOM continues to describe these attacks as defensive. With respect, aren't you stretching the definition of defensive?
Actually, no, I don't think so at all. I think these attacks are designed to prevent future attacks on us, which would be the definition of a defensive action. Clearly, dropping a bomb is in and of itself an offensive tactical action, but in a broader context, these are designed to be defensive strikes.
Sir, you talked about keeping two carrier strike groups in the region. Can you tell us which ones? We know the Eisenhower and the Truman are there now. Will the Truman extend its stay? And what's their mission as you see it? Is it, again, as a defensive measure, or do you see it in any other way should we be thinking about in terms of...
Sure. So the two carriers right now that are in the CENTCOM AOR, the Ike, the Eisenhower, she just came in, and the Truman. So we're going to keep them for a while, and I'm not going to comment on exactly how long that'll be because we typically try to avoid talking about tactical operations. The beauty of the aircraft carrier is this. It has enormous offensive capability. It has enormous defensive capability. It has mobility. We can move it around. Additionally, there are no access, basing, and overflight issues associated with an aircraft carrier. It's a floating piece of American sovereignty, so I can employ it in a variety of different ways. So we can move it around to present a completely changing potential threat to an adversary. So the carriers are very—they're very important to us, and we know that the Iranians watch them very closely too.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, you moved some of the 82nd out. Are we to take from this that rather than depending on ground troops, we'll see an increased security presence through the carriers, through the Navy, rather than through ground forces?
When I think about what's going on in the region, I think in a completely integrated fashion about the joint force. All elements of the joint force provide capabilities. You know, a battalion of the 82nd provides a unique capability. The carrier provides a unique capability. Land-based air, you know, marine aviation, a marine expeditionary unit. All are capabilities that we sort of stitch together in a mosaic.
Thank you. Sir, some of these pro-Iranian groups are integrated into the Iraqi army. So, first, did you consult with the Iraqi army before launching these strikes? And second, do you think it will hamper your negotiations with the Iraqi government to stay in Iraq?
So, we talk constantly at a variety of levels with the Iraqis. My level is the mill-to-mill level, the chief of defense level. General White, our commander on the ground, also engages at that level. So we have a continual dialogue about our presence going forward. And I believe when it's all said and done, the Iraqis are going to recognize the value that we bring by being there in the counter-ISIS fight and for other things as well. So my belief is that we're going to be able to negotiate this and we're going to be able to go forward and maintain a presence there. So as to whether we consulted with the Iraqis on this, we consulted with them in the wake of the attack. They knew that a response was coming, and I'll just leave it at that.
And do you think that they are going to keep these groups inside their armed forces with all the problems it creates for you?
We would certainly urge them that to not do that and to minimize that to the maximum extent possible.
General, thanks for doing this. First of all, you said you consulted with the Iraqis. However, the official account of the security media cell that is associated with the Prime Minister of Iraq described what happened, the U.S. attack, as an assault. And in the tweet yesterday, they mentioned, I guess, a contingency within their special forces that belongs to the military that was hit. That's the first question. When you say you consulted with them, it seems they were not happy with what happened. The second question, on the Hill, you described the type of deterrence you have against Iran as rough or contested. I believe that these were your words. Does that mean we're going to see this cycle of attacks by a group associated with Iran and then the U.S. strike back? What does contested deterrence mean exactly?
Sure. So let me take the first part of your question. I don't know whether the Iraqis are happy or unhappy. We talked to them and expressed our concern after the attack. These locations that we struck are clear locations of terrorist bases. If Iraqis were there and if Iraqi military forces were there, I would say it's probably not a good idea to position yourself with Khatib Hezbollah in the wake of a strike that killed Americans and coalition members. So to the second part of your question, we use the phrase contested deterrence to describe where we are now with Iran. We believe that we have established a level of state-to-state deterrence and that Iran does not seek a large-scale military exchange with the United States. However, as the maximum pressure campaign continues, Iran still seeks ways to reduce the diplomatic and economic effects of that campaign by military action, and military action in two domains, either direct or indirect. Direct would be state on state, and we think that's unlikely. Indirect would be through continued proxy actions, and that's continuing engagement that we're going to have to deal with in the theater going forward. I believe the actions that we took today or yesterday are going to send a signal that we're not going to tolerate that continued indirect approach, particularly when it causes loss of life.
Can you, General Kinsey, can you update us on the Patriot and CRAMs, if the Iraqi government has approved that or where in the process that is? And then just following on that, where would you characterize the continued asymmetric threat? Is the level of tension or threat as high as it was right after the Soleimani death, or is it down? I mean, can you just give us like your overall assessment of where that threat lies?
Sure. Right, so now? Let me actually start with that because it sort of leads in. It's a broader question. So I think the threat remains very high. I think the tensions have actually not gone down. I think that Iran has learned some lessons from the Soleimani exchange because they have always respected our capability, but they have had doubts about our will, and so our will is now a little more obvious to them about what we're going to do. So I think that has had an effect on their calculus. I still think they are acting.
Now, mind you, you've seen because, listen, so this would have happened, I believe, at around 1300, about in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. So I believe that Iraq is 6 hours ahead. So the strike happens Saturday in Iraq. So less than 12 hours later, right? You know, General McKenzie, so wrong in his estimation of the impact of us hitting ammunition supply points. Interesting. And again, what's the next shoe?
actively seeking ways to achieve destabilization that would allow them to escape the strictures of the maximum pressure campaign. So I believe that is still very much alive and well. And I think I said in my testimony that the illusion of normality is just that. It's the illusion of normality. The stress and the pressure is there. It's very real. Perhaps coronavirus even increases that on them because they have really, I think, first of all, the depth of the infection in Iran is underreported. That is our judgment. It has affected senior leaders, and so that produces an effect on decision making. And in authoritarian states, they can react to an internal crisis by one of two ways. They can turn inward or they can turn outward. History typically tells us authoritarian states turn outward in order to marshal the people behind them against a common foe, external, either manufactured or real. So I think it's very, very possible that that's what we're seeing right now. So the bottom line is I think the tension is still very high. I think the risk is still significant in the theater. And even though we may go days or a period of time without anything happening, I think we're still at a period of significant risk. So the second part of your question was, what about moving? We are moving Patriots into Iraq now. We've begun the preparatory. We have put the preparatory material in place that will allow us to establish Patriot positions inside Iraq in terms of CRAM and other close-in weapon systems that are used to defend those systems as they come in. We're still some days away from those systems being ready. The one thing I would point out to you, and I know that you realize this, Courtney, is the Patriot does not protect against a 107-millimeter rocket, and we should be very clear on that. The Patriot is something that you would use against the types of rockets that Iran used in their state-on-state attack of early January when they struck Al-Assad.
But the CRAMs could potentially, right?
The CRAMs can, but they are not a panacea, and the CRAMs are actually linked to protection of the Patriots. Because once the Patriots come in, they become a very high-value target without the ability to defend themselves. So typically we associate CRAMs and the close-in protective weapon systems with the ability to protect the Patriots.
Thanks.
Sure.
Hey, so just one clarification on Courtney's question. So did we not have CRAMs in place to protect against this kind of attack? That's my first question. And then my second question is that there's been reporting that you're sending some troops home. From Kuwait. Are these orders on hold now? Are you reevaluating in light of this decision? And are the guys who were already sent home going to have to turn around and come back?
So the fact of the matter is we have more locations in the theater where we have soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines than we have the ability to protect. So we have to ruthlessly prioritize. And we can't have CRAM everywhere we want it to be. And that's just a fact. It's an unpleasant fact, but it's one we deal with all the time. I'm typically the person in concert with my three-star subordinate commanders who makes the decisions about where to put close-in protective defensive systems. They just can't be everywhere. So that's the reason that there wasn't one at Taji. And we continually evaluate the tactical situation. But if I were, for example, to put one at Taji, it would have to come from another defended location, a defended location that we made a conscious decision was important enough to be defended. So that's just a constant. It's a zero-sum game, and we balance that all the time as we take a look at that. So in terms of forces flowing in and out of the theater, occurs all the time. You know, we brought some of the 82nd forward. We've sent some of it home. We've retained some of it in the theater. I'm actually not aware of any particular move because I don't track those closely unless there's something significant about it. So I'm really not tracking anything large fixing to happen.
Are you evaluating a new package of forces to come forward now that this has happened?
I'm in constant dialogue with the Secretary of Defense about the situation in the theater. I'll give you an example where the Secretary, I think, made a very good call. He allowed me to keep the second carrier for a period of time. So that's an example of me talking to the Chairman and the Chairman and Secretary weighing it and the Secretary making the decision. And one final thing, I'm keenly aware of how valuable aircraft carriers are. They do great things in other parts of the world. I did not spend my whole life in CENTCOM. I was up here on the joint staff in a prior life, and I know the cost we pay when we keep two carriers in the CENTCOM AOR.
The Iraqis said that that a civilian airport was hit. Do you know anything about that accusation? And do you expect, I mean, obviously there was a British soldier killed as well. Do you expect to be working with your colleagues in Britain on any kind of follow-on action after this? And is this it? Is this the response in its entirety for the attack that killed these people?
So there was a structure near the Kabbalah airfield where weapons were being stored. You can look on the graphic. It's actually a pretty good, I think it's, Yeah, A3. Yeah, it's over there, and you can take a look at it. But the fact of the matter is that was a clear target. It may have been on the airfield. I can't tell you what else was in there, but I know it was being used for purposes to target us. So that's the reason that we struck it. As to whether this is over, I'll just leave that one alone. We'll continue to evaluate the situation going forward without making a judgment one way or another on that. I know the British took a casualty in this. We continue to work with them on a way forward.
I think you described this as being restoring deterrence with the cage. How would you describe the impact of these strikes? Are they significant? Are they going to reduce their capability to launch these kinds of strikes in the future? And what exactly do you think is the universe of the capability of 107 missiles? Are there other kind of Katyusha rockets that have been used in the past?
Sure. So sometimes it's hard to establish deterrence with a non-state entity. A better way to phrase it might be, they know there's going to be a significant cost if they persist in this behavior in the future. And we're prepared to make them pay that cost, and it should be very obvious to them as a result of that. You know, anytime we conduct these operations, though, we're very careful to balance what we do to Katib Hezbollah against the potential collateral effects of what we do to the wider Iraqi community. So the weaponeers look very hard at these targets, and we try to do our very best to achieve precise effects against those that we want to go against. So, look, the 107 is an old tried and trusty weapon. There are a lot of them in Iraq. There are better and more precise weapons in Iraq as well. There's a broad universe of choices. But what should now be obvious to everyone is you're not going to be able to fire those at a U.S. or coalition base, hurt or kill our people, and escape unscathed.
So do you think this is like the breadth of their capability, or is it much larger and this is just a prick?
I think Katib Hezbollah is an organization that from its patron, Iran, has received a lot of advanced conventional weapons, and this is only one element of it.
Hi, sir. Tara Kopp with McClatchy.
Sure.
These five sites, do you assess that there are other Katib Hezbollah weapon storage facilities around the area that should be targeted or could be targeted and could be a threat to U.S. forces?
Yes, there are a variety of other sites.
So why choose just these five, I guess?
Restraint.
Restraint.
Restraint. Attempting to send a strong enough message. If it doesn't work, we got plenty more places we can go and go to work, and I'm confident we'll do that.
To the extent that you can you quantify plenty? Is it dozens? Is it hundreds of weapons storage sites throughout the country?
There are a lot of storage sites across the country. We think we know where most of them are.
Thank you.
Hi, General Carla Babb with Voice of America. I just wanted to follow up really quickly. You had said that the fact of the matter is the U.S. has more locations in theater than we have the ability to protect. Isn't that kind of an argument for less troops in the region? And then I wanted to follow up on your testimony on Capitol Hill. You said you really have to look to Iran because Iran needs to understand that we hold them ultimately accountable for these Shia militia group attacks. So how is attacking these sites on KH ultimately getting Iran to understand that they're accountable?
Sure.
This is the best question of the press conference so far.
So, you know, the logical, if the object were to allow no one to come at risk, we should bring everybody back to the United States. The fact of the matter is we have national objectives in the region that require us to be there. So we're probably not going to be able to bring people out or collapse the basing structure. The basing structure that we have is designed to allow us to go after our objectives in the region. And so as we lay that out and we look at the defensive capabilities that we have, we constantly balance those to put defensive capabilities where we feel we're most threatened. And that evolves as you would expect, as the threat evolves as well. So there are always going to be more locations that we're going to have the capability to protect. In a perfect world, we'd be able to protect everybody. We just can't do that all the time. But we're very careful, and we have a very good intelligence-driven process to put resources where we think we're the most threatened. Now, the second half of your question. So we do believe that behind Katib Hezbollah, ultimately, is the state of Iran. And the state of Iran is very much aware that we hold them responsible for what Katib Hezbollah does. And I would just leave that at that level right there.
But how does the strikes on KH ultimately pressure Iran?
So I think in this case, we went after the proximate entity that conducted the attack. I would not give you an opinion about what we might or might not do in the future.
Notice did not answer the question. in terms of how does this ultimately pressure Iran. Now, again, I'd be more comfortable, and maybe he can't say it in public, in this. We're not going to give Iran the boogeyman that they want, and so we're going to show restraint. We are conducting, you know, other operations against them, right? And they know. So to me, that makes, okay, I got it. Because if you recall, when they launched their attack on the Saudi oil production facilities, Tim Lynch and I and Jeff Kenny were on talking about that. And we came to the conclusion that the best thing to do is nothing. They knew that we would know who did it. Why? Because the sanctions are having an effect. They've got no relief from Europe. Now the coronavirus, right? Lowest voter turnout since 1979. The diagnostics of Iran are not positive right now for the ruling organization. So that would make sense to me. Okay? That would make sense to me. But again, just playing whack-a-mole with them is not the answer. They understand, you know, strength. So again, I would hope that the reason that we saw the week with Swans or against ammunition supply points is simply because we believe Iran is strangling. That's our assessment from our intelligence people, and we're not going to give them the boogeyman that they need.
Can I have a follow-up just to go back to what several of us have asked? So you know there's other sites out there. There's other Qatib Hezbollah sites. Then you know it's a threat to U.S. forces, and you describe this as restraint if the message is sent. But my two questions, I still don't get it, is when it came to ISIS, there was no question of not attacking ISIS targets. You went after everything, I think, you saw that you could find that you could prosecute. Why restraint? Why wait if you know there's sites where people want to attack and kill U.S. troops? And is that something that is being put upon you from other levels, from the Secretary of Defense or the White House? Do you have a different view about how you would do this if you were able to solely make that decision yourself? It's not clear to me why, if you know there are sites out there trying to kill American troops, you wouldn't go after them.
Sure. So, first of all, we work with the government of Iraq to go after these sites all the time with varying degrees of success. If we have information on a site, we share it with our Iraqi partners, and they'll go after those sites, sometimes effectively, sometimes not effectively. I'm not going to say that it always works, but it's their country. We need to give them the opportunity to do it. The second point is, when we look at sites, often they're commingled with civilian activities, and there's a very high probability of civilian damage if we strike those sites. The United States is not going to do that. If we strike a site, we're going to find a site that provides collateral damage consistent with the law of armed conflict and our values. So there are a lot of sites I could strike, but I would kill a lot of innocent people if we did that. We're just going to take that risk because that's the way we fight, and we're not prepared to go out there and do it that way, even if that places a higher degree of risk on us. And the last point is, nobody puts any pressure on me to modify this or do it one way or another. I have a very good direct exchange with the chairman and with the Secretary of Defense on this. We are completely aligned in the way we look at the problem here.
Do you think there's prosecutable sites out there today? Again, no minimum civilian casualty, minimum other problems. Are there prosecutable targets out there today?
There are always prosecutable targets out there, but we balance what we do in prosecuting these targets against our respect for the government of Iraq and their sovereignty. As always, it's a multivariable problem, and so there might be targets that I would strike. The cost of doing that with the government of Iraq is very high, and we have to respect to some degree the government of Iraq's wishes. It is, after all, their country. We are there at their request, and so so if we do that, I would expect them to do more to help us as well. So in the middle of that, that is an ongoing negotiation, and we're in the middle of it right now.
Thank you.
Sure.
Sir, I wonder if you could just expand a little bit more on the post-Soleimani world in the region. Because on one hand, I think you're saying they miss Soleimani, I think they said, but the risk remains significant. In the kind of, what's the net result, do you think, where you sit now in removing General Soleimani in terms of lowering the risk of of danger there.
So I think Soleimani was an effective, able terrorist commander. I think he'd been at the game for a long time. I think he drew all the threads together. There's a danger when you do that, because if you go away, nobody can step in. So I think the malign aspirations that lie with Iran to eject the United States from the theater, to assert its brand of theology elsewhere in the theater, all of those remain alive. What is different now in the wake of Soleimani is he's not there, and they miss him. Their ability to exercise effective command and control has been damaged because of that. The intent is still there. They're just not as good at carrying out as they were while he was still alive. And so that, someone has replaced him. I don't think that someone is going to be as good as him in the short term. We'll see how it works out in the long term. But in the principal thing I would draw from the wake of his death is it's harder for them to make effective decisions. It's harder sometimes for them to convey their will to their proxies. And so that, coupled with the shoot down of the jetliner over Tehran, has induced singular pressure on Iranian leadership, and we're still seeing that manifested right now. None of their core objectives have changed. None of that has changed. It's merely their ability to execute and their ability to make decisions within their national defense security-making process.
Good. But if I could just clarify, so of the danger and the peril and the threat posed by Tehran to the U.S. and to the region, how much of it do you assess is potential retaliatory actions by Tehran because of the Soleimani strike?
You know, it's hard to know. It's hard to know, Gordon, just how much. I think they feel that his loss very keenly. I don't know if they're finished with it yet. You know, a theory would be the attack on al-Assad, finished that. I'm not sure that we would agree completely that that's the case. I think it's still too soon to tell, to be very candid with you.
Sir, a couple questions on the rocket strike. You said KH had launched about a dozen in the last several months. How did this one compare in size and scope beyond casualties? Second, you captured the vehicle, but how were you able to capture that vehicle? Did you capture any KH members or anything like that as well?
So we assessed the intent was to fire 33 rockets. They fired 30. Three were left in the vehicle and failed to ignite. Of the 30 that were fired, between 8 and 12 or 8 and 15 landed in Taji. That's a large strike. I mean, that's an intent to produce a lot of casualties. So, we're certain of that. We're certain of the data. We also get very good point of origin data that we're able to look at from our radars.
So what you have is what's called counter battery radar. And, it's a big deal when you try to protect yourself, and essentially these radars shoot a horizontal beam across an area. Now the problem is a lot of times you don't have 360 coverage, so sometimes you might get something that comes out of an area that you don't have coverage on, depending on how many of these radar units you have. Because they don't radiate 360 degrees. They radiate about in a 45-degree arc, so you can aim them someplace. So anyhow, what happens is with that horizontal beam, you get it broken when a round comes out, right, and breaks the horizontal beam. And then you get it broken a second time, right, when it comes back to the ground. So you have a POO, point of origin, and you have a POI, point of impact. And so you can, immediately what happens is that gets put into a chat site. If there's a drone or an aviation asset up above, they get the grid coordinate. And within, a lot of times within less than, two or three minutes, you have somebody's eyes on that piece of dirt. And if they're mobile trying to get away, which it would be if they were using a mortar system, right, that they would have to pack up, throw in the back of a truck, hop in the truck, there might be a chance that you would see them leaving. You would see them packing up, you would leaving. With rockets, and again, the reason why they're the weapon of choice is you can set a dryer timer for an hour. Set it up, set the timer, and leave, and it fires electrically. So as soon as the timer closes the circuit, boom, they all go. And you're nowhere near to be found. So hence the weapon of choice. But that's kind of a longer explanation than General McKenzie gives.
And the Iraqis actually went out and got the vehicle for us, which was very much appreciated. But as usual, typically the vehicle is left with a timer. There's nobody there when the rockets are fired, which is why the remaining three probably couldn't be ignited, because they set a timer on it and run away. A particularly cowardly way to fight, but there you go. And so that's how we get to that. So, you know, we're processing that vehicle. We'll process the three remaining rockets, and we'll gain a lot of information out of that that will allow us to further particularize and work on the origins of this attack.
Sir, just a follow-up. Why weren't you able to see these missiles in advance? Why, if you knew where the warehouses were, why weren't you able to track them and see before they were fired?
Sure. So vehicles, rockets are loaded in these trucks. That truck may have moved around for a month before it was taken to the, because they know we're looking. And actually, I don't have enough ISR to be everywhere all the time. You know, it's a common misconception that we see everything. We see some things really well, but when we see some things really well, that means we pay an opportunity cost. And I see nowhere, you know, see nothing somewhere else. Just the nature of the business, we juggle that all the time. So possibly this truck was loaded. It may have been hidden around. It was moved around. They are very good at doing this because they know. Like, for example, had we seen that truck, we would have taken action. That's an earlier question about, do you have to wait to be hit? No. If we see the truck, we'll take that truck out immediately. So they know that as well, so they're very cautious. The truck was probably covered until seconds before they set the timer and ran away. So you've got a very limited period of time when it appears as a missile-loaded truck.
Since we have you here, can you just give us an update on Afghanistan and where things are with the beginning of the inter-Afghan dialogue and talks and the prisoner exchange, anything you can share?
Sure. So did a lot of testimony on that this week, so I'll just sort of draw on that. And I'm going to talk really the military line because that's what I know the best. Taliban attacks are still too high. Taliban attacks are not occurring against coalition forces. They're not typically occurring in the cities, and they're not occurring against bases. They're occurring against checkpoints and out in isolated locations across Afghanistan. But the level of attacks, in my judgment, is not consistent with a group that wants to pursue and be a fair and faithful partner going forward. So those attacks are too high. And we have noted, I've seen what the Afghans have said, if they don't knock them off here in another 2 or 3 days, they're going to begin to respond. So I think actually the Afghan government has been remarkably restrained in responding to the Taliban attacks. So the question is, do the Taliban attacks represent a core strategy of the group? They're going to continue the attacks, or is it a splinter of the group, and are they not monolithic? We're still assessing that. If it's directed from the top, then obviously that's not a good thing because it shows that they're not acting in good faith. We are in the process of drawing down to a level of 8,600. I anticipate that we'll arrive at that level by the middle of the summer. We believe that any further as we go beyond that, it's going to be a conditions-based approach. We have an aspiration to go to a zero level in Afghanistan, but that is very clearly going to be conditions-driven. We'll have an opportunity to take a look at conditions as we go forward. And my job and General Miller's job will be to evaluate the military component of that. The inter-Afghan dialogue, as an observer, clearly that has to happen. Clearly, our ability to go down below that level balanced against our commitment to our key interests in the region, which is preventing the generation of attacks from ISIS and al-Qaeda against the United States homeland and the homelands of our allies and partners. That's what drives our decision on what that force level needs to be. If you have a permissive environment in Afghanistan, you can go much lower. If you have a non-permissive environment where the Taliban is actively pursuing operations against at least the Afghans and possibly us, then you're going to need to recommend a larger force structure. I'll have an opportunity to make that recommendation as the process goes forward. Ultimately, it's not a military decision.
Can I follow up on Courtney's question, Taliban?
Last one, sir. You've said that coronavirus had some impact on Iran's senior leadership, potentially made them more aggressive. I'm curious if you can characterize how permanent that might be and just what impact you've seen, if you could provide more details.
Well, sure. Of course, death is permanent, and a number of people have died as a result of that in the Iranian senior leadership cadre. So I think it's going to have, in the short term, it's going to make it a lot harder to make decisions. People are separated. They're distrustful. And then there's a lot of, public anger in Afghanistan about the mishandling of the coronavirus coming on the heels of the shoot down of the jetliner. So I think those all represent pressures that act on Iranian leadership right now. And that's going to be presumably passing, but again, leaders have died, and those leaders are not going to come back as a result of that. So it's a combination of the two. I think the net effect of the coronavirus and the COVID-19 is that it has increased pressure on Iran's strategic decision makers. Thanks very much. Thank you.
That's probably the most interesting part of that plays into, hopefully, in my opinion, why the response in Iraq is so muted, trying not to give Iran what I believe the American assessment is, and that is the American assessment is they have senior leaders dying. They have all kinds of internal issues. You know, General McKenzie just cited the shoot down of the airliner. The biggest thing the Iraqis, after the Soleimani, you know, when they went into the streets to do whatever they did when after Soleimani was killed, that quickly turned into, right, protests against the government because of the lying about the shoot down of the airliner. Now, the lack of a response to COVID-19 and what Iranians, again, are saying is they lied to us at the start of it, right, saying that they had it under control when they didn't. So to me, I keep my fingers crossed that the muted American response, right, is an assessment that Iran is getting more unstable, and we do not want to give them that which we assess, to use Intel guy talk, we assess that this is an attempt to provide them a boogeyman the same way that the attack on the Saudi infrastructure was. So, again, I keep my fingers crossed that that's it. I hope it's just not us playing the stupid Iraqi game. Now, I want to play for you one more piece of audio that I thought was interesting, and that is talk about how COVID-19 has impacted the Chinese economy. Now, just know this, that the Chinese response to it much different than, you know, a free democratic nation's response, okay? China, as a totalitarian government, can lock that son of a bitch down. So this is from a discussion from the South China Morning Post, and you're going to hear a bunch of guys with British accents talking about the Chinese economy. And so it'll give you some kind of clue into how this will impact the American economy, although we're not identical, certainly.
For you, first look at the economic data, which is reflecting what's been going on with the COVID-19 pandemic in China. Finbar, start with you. How bad is it?
It's pretty bad, Joe. Most of the numbers that came out this morning indicated record lows in China. We had...
This is a guy named Finbar. What's his name? Finbar something Birmingham. It looks like Birmingham. Probably not, but because there's something blocking. Oh, Birmingham, right? He's a writer, business writer for the South China Morning Post. All right, so they're sitting around talking about the economic impact relative to China.
Industrial production, which is a measurement of manufacturing and mining, really China's famous manufacturing economy, and it was in negative territory for January and February for the first time. Now, this is because all of the factories in China, most of the factories were closed down for a prolonged period. Some of them remain shut. So basically, these factories have had to grind to a halt, and they're slowly trying to get their production back up and running again. We also saw a complete collapse in retail, which is, again, not very surprising considering large swathes of China has been on lockdown. People have not been able to go to the shops. They haven't been able to do their shopping, and they've been buying predominantly online. That's been reflected in the fact that retail sales fell by 20%, 20.4% in the first 2 months of the year. We also had fixed asset investment, which fell by 24.5%. Again, this shows that businesses have not been able to invest in equipment, in property. And I guess what you're seeing overall there is an absolutely devastating picture for the Chinese economy in the first 2 months of the year. This is combined data for January, February. We'll wait and see whether it gets back to normal in March. Probably not, but it's pretty bad.
Now, John, I wanted to ask you, you know, China seems to be getting a handle on the health crisis itself, but of course the rest of the world is just now starting to deal with the coronavirus. What does that mean for China?
Well, first, for China, they are starting to get a handle on the virus, but they're still in the process of getting their economy back online. Remember that the Wuhan lockdown started January 23, almost 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And so they're still getting their industry online. They're still, many shops have not reopened, and this will take more time, probably into April at least. And that is what we can expect from the rest of the world. In Europe, Italy, as we know, is on lockdown, but Spain just went on lockdown. Germany just closed its borders. And so Europe is just starting the very strict steps that China took 2 months ago. So what's the economy in Europe going to look like 2 months from now? The U.S. is even farther behind. New York City just banned eating out yesterday, and they've closed the schools. But most of America has not started to take the drastic steps that people think are necessary to control the virus. So it may be even longer than 2 months before we know what's going on in the U.S.
Now, I take exception to that. First of all, the problem, that as it happened in China, right, has not been the problem as it has materialized in the United States. So I think he's wrong about that. So to me, the Chinese problem was much, much larger, right? Much larger, much faster. And, you know, the President of the United States closing travel to Asia, you know, gave the country more time to deal with it. So I think he's wrong about that.
Finbar, I realize these are, you know, a kind of initial look at this, but
we will see, though.
Compared to looking at the historical background of, you know, what we've been dealing with our economies around the world, how unprecedented is this?
I mean, it's absolutely unprecedented. This has never happened before. And, you know, from covering supply chain and trade over the past couple of months, when you speak to people who run businesses and factories in China, they've said, well, we don't really know what we're doing because we're dealing with the unknown. Speaking to economists about data that's coming out, they're really struggling to update their models in time with the news headlines. The pace of which this is unfolding is really unprecedented. So while people are saying this is better or worse than the global financial crisis, this is, you know, it's comparable with a sort of wartime lockdown in the global economy, these are all valid points, but it's really worth remembering that nobody actually can predict with any clarity what will happen here. As John has just said, it's a moving picture. The US is just going into various states of lockdown at the moment, so we really do not know where this will end up.
John, a little bit more about the employment figures that have come out. I mean, of course, this all happened right around the time of the Lunar New Year. China, of course, being famous as the largest human migration in the world, and that's primarily these migrant workers from cities. What are these numbers reflecting about that?
Well, the surveyed unemployment rate, which is what Western economies do, is they do a survey to see what the unemployment rate is. And in China, you can only survey people who have fixed jobs or in offices for the most part. And so that went up a full percentage point from 5.2 to 6.2, which is a big jump for China, where that unemployment rate had been relatively steady around just above 5% for months and months and months. So there's a big jump, but that does not include most migrant workers because they can't be surveyed. And migrant workers are being hit hardest because of the travel bans, because of the closing of the factories, closing of the shops. And so they aren't counted. So the real unemployment rate may be much larger. And another point I'd like to make about factories returning to work in China is just, yes, they are coming back online, but one of the big new challenges they're going to face is lack of demand from the West. No new orders from Europe or the United States, which may mean there'd be a second round economic effect on them.
Mm. And for both of you, of course, everybody's asking a question about, is this a low point? Have we hit a low point here or not?
Well, I think that the Chinese government would certainly hope so. At the press conference in Beijing today, those were the sorts of noises that they were making. I think what John said there is really important. The second wave economic impact is a global economy. This is not a zero-sum game. You know, it's not like China recovers and it's back on track. It's reliant on demand from the rest of the world. Also, on the factories reopening, only 60% of businesses in China as of last Friday, according to the Ministry of Industry, were reopened. I mean, that's just over half of all the businesses in China were reopened. So there's 40% still closed. I mean, that's massive. Like, if you think about the size of China's economy and how many businesses that means are still shut. So, you know, you would maybe think that it has hit its bottom and is on the way up, but I mean, the numbers are still astronomical. It's really hard to make any concrete observations.
All right, John Finbar, thank you for your reporting and to the entire team, and we look forward to hearing more.
Pretty interesting, I thought, when I listened to that yesterday, and that is one is there's a second round of economic impact. So once you go, that mean that China will experience that maybe the rest of the world doesn't. Maybe the rest of the world's second round of economic impact is not as significant because the way this thing ripples. And if it ripples for your country last, the rest of the world kind of up and running. And so as your business come back online, hopefully there's backlog of orders and business to do, especially for manufacturers. If you come up first, as I said right at the end there, the West isn't ordering, right? Nobody's ordering, as they've shut down their economies. And so for a manufacturing-based economy, that's huge. And then the other part of it is, will countries like the United States, right, like Western Europe, look and say, you know what, we have a dependency on the Chinese that we're not real comfortable with, and we've got to put an end to that. So maybe all that business doesn't come back. So anyway, interesting stuff today. Okay, let me finish with this. If this is the worst thing that you ever go through in your life, God bless you. God bless you. Right? Means you lived a pretty good life. So, since there's nothing on TV, because there's no sports, find a book, right? Audible is having a sale today. 2-for-1 titles. So if you listen to books, you can get 2-for-1 today. I know, because I did it earlier today. So as we look for different things to do, don't be afraid to read. Don't be afraid to listen to books. Right? Some of the things you put off for a long time, start to do that. And all the other things you could do from your home, start your physical fitness routine that you've been putting off now that you have more free time. Yeah. Maybe do some family stuff that you haven't done in a while. You can go online. You can go to ancestry.com, build your family tree. There's all kinds of things that you can do with your family, right, now that you have some extra time. But as I said before, if this is the worst thing that happens to you in your life, you've lived a charmed life. So with that said, listen to what people say. Okay. Keep your distance socially. I had to go do two things. I bought a tablet a while ago, and I needed a case for it, and I needed some memory for it. So I had to go to a store to get the memory. So I did that. Stood in line, and you know, everybody's cool. Nobody's in each other's faces. Nobody was hacking and coughing. And so, you know, people, Americans, very cool. Unless you're in the supermarket with overweight people, which I guess gets very unpleasant. So anyway, and then from there, I did have to go to the supermarket. And I behaved myself. So do the things I tell you to do. I would say have a rubber surgical glove. So when you have to use those keypads that a lot of people use at ATMs and supermarkets when you're doing this stuff, right? Put your glove on. I was wearing a long sleeve hoodie yesterday, and I just slid the sleeve down, and I used that to punch my pin when I bought whatever I bought. So I would recommend that to you as well. But we'll get through this as a nation. We always do. Stock market will recover. And again, one other coping mechanism, turn the TV on mute. Turn the TV on. If you want to leave the news on, just hit the mute button. Don't listen to it. Yeah. If you do that, you'll be surprised. 8 weeks will come and 8 weeks will go. and this too shall pass. So, on a Monday, there's some words to live by. From an old guy. Yeah. 62 years old on the planet. So, and the last thing I'll leave you with is don't be afraid to change somebody's life. I got an email, had a text exchange over the weekend. Somebody who's been on this program, right, a friend committed suicide, and he said, I feel horrible, you know, that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do for them what you did for me. I said, hey, look, just so you know, doesn't work all the time. Doesn't work all the time. Second time I've heard that in a week. Second time I've heard that in a week. And so I had an awesome conversation with him. And it's at one point he said to me, he said, you know, Mac, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So I'm going to tell you, every one of us can do that kind of stuff. And it starts with being there for people. Starts with being there for people. But if I was going to tell you one thing to listen to that I've thoroughly enjoyed the last 10 days, listen to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History. Yeah, pretty interesting stuff. I might play a little segment of that tomorrow because there's a thing about homelessness that runs a very, very close parallel with what post-traumatic winning does. Yeah, so pretty interesting. Anyway, on a Monday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.